Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. There has always been a special relationship between the eye of the artist and the extraordinary events, tragic or euphoric, of human history. In this century, novelists such as Eric Maria Remarque and Ernest Hemingway have left us indelible portraits of the ravages of war. And no one can look upon Pablo Picasso's great mural, Guernica, without recoiling from the slaughter of civilians, which is an unfortunate hallmark of our time. The Holocaust in its immensity challenges the artist as it does the theologian, philosopher, or layperson. It is the artist, though, to whom we must turn for the most emotive and enduring interpretations of our human capacity for good and for evil. My guest is once again Donald McCullough, conductor of the Master Chorale of Washington and composer of the Holocaust Cantata. Donald, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thank you.
Donald, I wanted to continue our conversation because I wanted to, if you'll indulge me, get very personal with you about the work that we discussed last time, the cantata itself, of course, and hear some more of the cantata as we do so. But as I mentioned in the introduction to this conversation, it has seemed to me that the artist does have a special kind of moral responsibility in terms of what he or she does in composing. And in our first conversation, I got the sense that there was more to your work on this than just another piece of music. So I guess the first question is, do you agree that there is a special moral dimension, ideally, to what an artist does?
Certainly. And again, like anything, it can be used for good and sometimes I think used to, I mean, Hitler used art quite successfully and music, you know, so it just speaks to the power of it. But yes, I would hope that, at least for me personally, I think, mm-hmm. yes, I have a moral responsibility to use the gift as something that does more than make me happy, mm-hmm. you know.
On this business of using music as your way of making a statement about the world, your sense of it, you clearly do that. I mean, you obviously do that. And it reminded me of a phrase that I came across, and I can no longer remember where, but it spoke of music being, quote, the most enigmatic of the arts and the one that is most capable of making an emotional connection
right.
with the listener. I think that's what you were saying in a sense, that talk can do what it can do, but music either goes to the heart of the hearer or it doesn't. I mean, that if it does, it's the most powerful thing.
My friend and mentor, Alice Parker, who was the arranger for mm-hmm. Robert Shaw back in the Robert Shaw Chorale days and now a wonderful teacher and composer, and her phrase for it is the ability to glimpse the eternal, which sometimes at that one little magical moment that you have this, you feel like you've really seen truth and everything is put in perspective, and you realize perhaps the thing you're obsessing about is quite incredibly insignificant. Right. And it just kind of, it's like going to the chiropractor, I guess, going to a concert, I hope. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want choral music to be for people when they come to hear a concert. That's
exactly the point I want to turn to right now at this very moment, choral music, because that's been if not the largest part, certainly a very significant part of what you've done as a musician, what you're doing
right.
currently. And what is that all about? And let me try to explain my own question. What's the special artistic quality or contribution of the massed human voice? What does it do that other forms of musical expression don't do quite as well?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know that it is incredibly powerful, and I think one, it carries with it a specific message. Instrumental music doesn't have usually anything specific about it. I mean, it may be a piece about spring, so we hear springy things for 30 minutes. But if you've got good texts, and I think that's the key, mm-hmm. then you are really getting a double whammy. You're getting the power of music and the and being and with the literary aspect of it being carried by the music, which makes it all the more powerful. There's just something communal about singing, and in our in many, many cultures, it's something that people do together, and it creates a oneness. And I hate that it's become so professionalized in a way. I mean, I'm carrying the torch for professional singers. At the same time, I hate that people sitting in their, you know, synagogue or church are reluctant to sing out because they think they don't have a good voice, and it's not about that in that particular setting. But in that sense, everybody can relate to that. And I mean, maybe it's because the human voice is the oldest instrument, you know, it's the very first art, and in some deep genetic level, we know that. I don't know.
Well, I think you're touching on important elements of it, and what you put me in mind of is that I'm an opera buff, and one of my favorite operas is Boris Godunov, which is essentially a choral opera.
Right.
I mean, Mussorgsky composed this thing that's, and you sort of have a sense of the Russian people singing their story.
Yes.
And it's all the more powerful because, and I'm, here I'm going on and on, but the the massed voices of, you want to take over and be the host?
Sure.
The massed power of these voices.
Yes.
It's just amazing.
And there's just something, I mean, for me, the human voice, and I mean that when I hear it singing, when I warm my choir up, I love it.
Yeah.
It's not an exercise that I'm, you know, just going through so that I can get to the good stuff. Mm-hmm. Color, the color of the voice is it's incredible. And how many different sounds can we make? I mean, the violin's an incredible instrument, and I'm sure a violinist would tell you about the hundreds of colors they can bring to it, but it's nothing like the human voice and the vowels that we have, and we can color it bright or dark, or it just, I think it really is a wonder, and that's why I love it.
There's a question I wanted to ask you, Donald, that I had in mind before I met you, and I had some reluctance to pose it because it seemed to me, how do you work this in, although it's a subject of my curiosity. Now I feel less reluctant because I think we've been sort of approaching this in a way, and here is the question. And as I thought, as I composed it, it may seem an unusual point, but hearing the Holocaust cantata myself and thinking of the horror that preceded it, caused it, and haunted us after it, it made me in a curious way mindful of today's debate in our country over multiculturalism.
Yes.
And I hope that this is making some sense because it was kind of inchoate in my mind, but... So I guess I'm going to ask you straightforwardly, what do you think of the argument as a musician, as a scholar, a composer, that respecting a wide variety of ethnic cultures and their contributions, their art, their literature, and their music, is at least perhaps one antidote to the type of horror that this music memorializes, that the cantata memorializes? In other words, the ability of a society to be more respectful of all of the cultural trends that should make it up. Because a lot of this evil we've spoken about exists at a subconscious level, and culture can affect people that way. I mean, does this make any resonance?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I think in the music business, we struggle with this in terms of if you went to a conference 8 years ago, there would have been 3 workshops on multicultural programming to be sure we were, you know, hitting everybody and everybody was happy. And I do... It's a subject that I struggle with. Take, for instance, Black History Month. I think it's awful that we have to have it, but I think it's important that it is there. And I have done, in fact, a recording, but a lot of music of Adolphus Hailstork, who is an incredibly wonderful African-American composer. And I have to say that I first got interested in him. He was in my community because I thought perhaps I should do something for Black History Month. I hadn't. I mean, I just have to be honest and say I wasn't at that point yet, you know, and in developing my organization. But once I got to know him, and in fact, I studied with him for many years. He's a wonderful teacher, and a lot of his influence is in this work. I don't think of him as a Black composer so much as I do a composer, just quite simply. And so, but you know, I'm a WASP. I mean, I, I'm So I don't know if I can answer this question. I don't know what it feels like necessarily to be in a segment of society that feels like it's being ignored. Mm-hmm. And should we all become just kind of vanilla ice cream, you know what I mean? And just looking all the same, by that I mean American, quote yeah. unquote. But if you're not raised in a tradition of a particular culture, I'm not sure how much that music speaks to you. Now, certainly, I think in the African-American culture, that music is well integrated into classical music and all sorts. But it's a difficult question. I don't know. I don't really know how to answer it. I think I struggle with trying to say, what is my voice in that? Because yeah. I'm a person who, I want to be honest. I don't want to be disingenuous and go up there and say, well, I'm going to do this little set from Mexico just because I feel like I should. I've got to have some reason to feel like it's sending some message. I'm not going to present a gospel choir in February and say I've done my part for Black History Month and have a predominantly Black audience. I mean, what is that accomplishing if we're trying to get us to respect one another? Mm-hmm. That really is more like, well, you can go over there and do your thing and we hope you're happy, but we're certainly not going to be a part of it. Yeah. If you're presenting a concert where you're drawing an audience that is not a multi-ethnic audience. And so I think one of the most successful concerts I did like that was I did a tribute to Adolphus Hale Stark's music. And it was about 50% Black and 50% white. I thought that was wonderful.
I do too.
And they were all elated. I mean, they loved it. And it wasn't just, you know, I mean, so we were celebrating this African-American man and his music, but we could all go away really thinking of it as a man and his music who happened to be African-American.
Well, I wasn't there, but just that description makes me think that's the place we all have to get to.
Yeah, but it is hard.
It's hard.
It's very, very hard.
I asked that question because, quite frankly, I don't know the answer either, but I'm intrigued by this. And I guess one of the things that has always intrigued me about the Nazi horror was that so many people willingly went along with it.
Yes.
And I've often wondered, was part of that, at least part of that, because they had no conception of who the people in their midst were. You know, they didn't understand their culture or hear them or see them really in that way. I want to also point out, talking about this reminds me of something else you do, and that you've been active in D.C. public schools with choral music.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When I first came here, I wanted to have some kind of educational outreach program that was, again, effective. We were doing something that I didn't think was terribly effective. And so I went and visited all the music supervisors in the area. When I got to D.C., I discovered that they weren't doing things that is basic at most schools, and that is having what they call district chorus, where all of the best kids from different schools come together. And that allows them to perform at a higher level than they can in their own schools. And these being the best kids, this is a potential way of life for them, at least if not fulfilling, perhaps a way to make a living. And so we created an honors choir, and at the moment we are at the middle school level, and we do that very thing. Kennedy Center is a partner with us, and we get kids from all the schools in the district, have a guest conductor who works with them, and get them excited about, you know, performing at a really high level, and then they perform at the Kennedy Center, which is a wonderful experience for them.
Must be.
So we've done it 2 years, and it's been very exciting.
Donald, I want to thank you for this, letting us sort of open a door into your life and get a sense of the man behind the music. I think it's very important because the Holocaust Cantata, as you pointed out in an earlier conversation, is a statement about people, not numbers.
Right.
And I think people have a right to know the man who is the person behind this concept. Let me take a brief moment from our conversation just to say again that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Donald McCullough, conductor of the Master Chorale of Washington and composer of the Holocaust Cantata. Speaking that reminds me of something that I'm sure is in your mind. This was previously the Paul Hill Chorale.
Correct.
You've been conductor now 4 years or so?
I'm starting my fourth season.
Your fourth season. And as we both know, and many here in Washington, indeed around the world know, Paul Hill passed away in recent weeks. That, to my mind, cannot help but lend a special poignancy to your sense of this piece or any future performance of it? It's kind of a lament, isn't it, for anybody that passes away?
Yes, but you know, I guess it is. Perhaps the one song on there, which is not in the Holocaust Cantata, but that I composed for the concert, which is We Remember Them, which in this context we're thinking of the Holocaust victims, but it stands alone. It doesn't really mention the Holocaust. It could be a memorial of anyone. In fact, I wrote it with two people who were very dear to me, had just lost someone very close to them, and they were kind of in my mind when I wrote it. So in that sense, I suppose a piece like that would have us all thinking about Paul Hill. I have to say that when I do the Holocaust Cantata, I don't make that connection. It seems more like it's a message for the living, for the healthy living. And it is more about that than it is lamenting those who suffered. And that is certainly part of it. But I want it to go beyond that. You have in the middle of it, you are remembering, and I think you are lamenting. And by the end, I hope you're asking yourself, and days to come, and hopefully throughout the rest of your life, the hard questions, and perhaps in some little way, and that's, you know, how I guess things happen. I mean, that's how the Holocaust happened. It was little teeny things that eventually added up to be incredibly big things.
Absolutely.
So I would say that I'm so almost, I guess, focused on the message of it that it doesn't have that effect on me.
We're going to, and I think very importantly, here We Remember Them as the final, in the final portion of this conversation. I had intended to anyway, and now I think it's absolutely essential.
Okay.
Before that, though, I want to turn to a couple of more segments from the cantata, as we did in the first program, and I'd like to suggest we both listen to and then talk briefly about A Song of Days Now Gone.
Oh, Mother, I would like so much to be a child again, like years before, and hide again in your arms. After you kissed me farewell on my forehead, I faced a horribly evil world far away from you. Day after day passes, and I only know one thing, that I must return, because I want to reward your pain, O Mother, and kiss the tears away from your eyes.
That precedes this is a Prisma prisoner expressing her sentiments about missing her mother.
Right, it's called Letter to Mom. Mm-hmm. And it actually, I believe, was words to a song. And I should say here that so much of the power of this is because I had a great lyricist. Mm. And my partner, Denny Clark, is the one who took the literal translations that a young man named Marcin Chmudzki, who was Polish, who helped me at the museum find what I was looking for. He did a literal word-by-word translation. And then Denny Clark turned that into poetry, in effect, or the lyrics, and tried to stay very honest to what was actually written. And So this particular song, I think, is, you earlier on the last show asked about why the cello, and this was certainly an inspiration. Cello play the sad song. I mean, and this was one of the first pieces that I worked on, even though it is the last piece of the cantata. At that time, I didn't know that it would be. And the cello is, it's asking the cello to play the sad song, Song of Days Now Gone. And I think it works,
I think so too,
you know, very well in that context.
I'd be really remiss, Donald, if I don't ask you this, because I know everyone who's listened to the first program and this conversation is probably saying, ask this question, George, and that is, when and where will it be performed next? Are there plans?
Don't have a clue. It's the CD is now released.
Wonderful. What label is it?
It's on the Albany label, mm-hmm. and it's called Holocaust Cantata, Songs from the Camps is the subtitle. And the score, because I hope that people will perform it, is being released by Henshaw Music, and that will come out in January or February. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have specific plans at the moment to do it again. I hope that we will do it on a fairly regular basis at the Holocaust Museum, but it's same old problem of busy lives and, yeah. you know, just getting that arranged and all of that. So
you didn't come here for my personal suggestions, but since you're here, let me give offer one if I might by way of encouragement, and that is we sit, you and I, speaking at the end of 1999, and as everyone says very portentously these days, at the end of the 20th century,
right.
we can say we're doing that, which means, of course, the 21st century starts practically tomorrow. And
right.
It seems to me that this is an important part of the legacy, however evil, of this century, to be remembered in the new millennium, even as people are expressing all the great hopes.
Absolutely.
I would think a performance of this as the new century opens would be an important statement.
I think it's a great suggestion.
Thank you, sir. Don, I want to conclude this second of our conversations by turning to a piece that, as I understand it, you wrote as separately.
Right.
But functions, may I suggest, as a coda, in a sense, to
right.
the Holocaust Cantata, and a really a powerful statement of its themes. It's We Remember Them. And what I propose we do is listen to a fairly extended portion of this and then get your final thought.
Great.
I don't have a brilliant final question because I think the message is before us. And something you said earlier about music speaking as a message has just done that. But I do want to ask you, Don, if there is a concluding thought that you want people to take away from actually all the things we've talked about over two conversations.
Well, I guess I've really... Well, let me say this. That piece of music that we just listened to, We Remember Them, it is basically saying in the summer, in the winter, in the spring, anytime, everything makes us remember. I mean, in other words, you can't forget. At any moment, you can't forget. You can't let yourself get off guard, be off guard. You have to constantly remember. And this really is perhaps... more than anything, the little requiem. You were asking me earlier if the Holocaust Cantata, if I thought of it as that, and I'm hoping for the message that comes out of it to be the thing that really stays with people as much as the remembering. Here, I think we are now in our own time. We're not looking back to when it happened, but as a group of people gathered at that particular moment, now that's what we're doing. It's almost that communal act of remembering at that point. And I just did this piece with 350 high school kids. And I can tell you that when I conducted that in performance, it'll be a long time before I forget that experience, because they knew the context. I explained to them why I had written it. And it was quite wonderful. And it was wonderful to see that they were touched and moved by it, and many of them asking me questions, and it just did the very thing that I wanted it to. So I guess my concluding thought is I hope that this music stirs people up and helps them to once again perhaps struggle with things that they quit struggling with, because it's too hard. It's a hard subject. And so I hope that we will all continue to struggle and, you know, keep that remembering in front of us so that we're committed to not letting it happen again, whether on that incredible, horrific scale or the person down the street.
Donald, let me just say it's been a great pleasure to make your acquaintance, sir.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And to have talked about this indeed very important piece of music. And I guess my only concluding thought is I do hope that people will make a point of hearing this, either by recording and quite frankly, I pray that it's performed in public soon and often.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
A pleasure.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Donald McCullough, conductor of the Master Chorale of Washington and composer of the Holocaust Cantata. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Kirsten LaCour-Dabelko. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.